Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Biography. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today, I'm talking with Jeffrey Stewart about his biography of the author and educator Alan Locke, entitled The New Negro, The Life of Alan Locke. Jeffrey, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for agreeing to come on our podcast. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Well, I'm a professor of Black Studies at UC Santa Barbara in California, and I'm a historian primarily. And I've been working on the biography for some time. Really started interested in it when I was a graduate student at Yale in 1979, and then put it aside and then came back to it. So I'm basically an intellectual historian, and I write on culture. Art history has been a particular interest recently, so I'm glad to have an opportunity to bring to life somebody who loved art very much.
You mentioned that in some ways this project dates back to your time in school. Did you envision that you would be writing a biography of Locke, or were you initially thinking of a slightly different project and it became a biography?
Yes. I thought it would have biographical elements, but it was really a kind of study or history of his ideas. At the time, I was particularly interested in the fact that he had been a friend of Horace Kallen, and together they had generated the concept cultural pluralism, the idea that to be an American, you didn't have to give up your ancestral culture, but you could be appreciative of your Jewish heritage as well as be American. You could have a sense of your African past and identity as well as be American. So that was what really got me interested. I had been a philosophy undergraduate major at UC Santa Cruz, and he was a philosopher interested in value theory. So that kind of was my initial connection with him, and I was really doing a history of ideas at that point.
It really, what you just described really points to the breadth of Locke's life that you present in the book, because he was a philosopher, he was a teacher, he was a sponsor of the arts, and he had this enormous influence upon American life at that time. And yet, while he's recognized for that by a lot of people, he doesn't have quite the same prominence as some of the other individuals that we associate with that era, like, say, W.B. Du Bois or Langston Hughes or Zora Neale Hurston. Do you think that's because he was a philosopher, or do you think that was because he didn't have quite the same big book or outsized platform that some of these other people did?
Yes, I think that's probably all of those things are factors. You know, philosophers aren't considered, you know, the leading lights of American history or society. Not like, for example, in France, Jean-Paul Sartre is considered, you know, a kind of heroic figure and, you know, is very well known. I think also, too, Locke avoided the civil rights activism that someone like W.B. Du Bois advocated or Martin Luther King practiced. So in that sense, when we think about the Black experience, typically in the United States, it's often seen within the frame of civil rights. And while he did have a real civil rights impact, feeling that art and culture was a way to advance civil rights, it wasn't in the way that, say, Du Bois writing essays on lynching and criticizing directly American political practices. He wasn't a person who did that, and so he doesn't come up on that radar. I also think that for many years, he's sort of an invisible figure because he's mainly a critic. He's not a creative writer like Langston Hughes or Zora Neale Hurston. He's not producing novels and poems. He's reacting to other people and promoting other people who do that, and that's a kind of a leading from behind sort of position in American letters that often is rather invisible. And finally, I think because he was gay, I think also made it somewhat difficult for some people to place him within the pantheon of typical African-American heroes. I know that when I was first starting out working on it, and even a little later, various people would say, well, you know, don't really do anything or say that much about the fact that he's gay, because that may turn some people off or whatever. So I think that to a certain extent, a lot of people sort of worked around him, or they liked his ideas, but to take on the biographical meant to take on issues of that they really didn't have a terminology in the 80s and early 90s to deal with. I think now we have the notion of intersectionality. We have a lot of more conceptual tools to discuss a life like his.
That's really fascinating, because in reading your book, his sexuality is so central to what you describe as his life. It's fascinating to imagine how much different your biography would have been had that not been there. It would have, given what I've learned from reading it, it seems like we would have only been discussing, say, 2/3 of his life.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could start us off by telling us something about his childhood, his upbringing, his background, because I was thinking about some of the things you were just discussing, and as you explain in the book, a lot of what these issues are informed by his childhood and by the context of the world in which he grew up.
Yes, well, I think one of the chapters a Black Victorian childhood. So essentially in the 19th century, really beginning in the first half of the 19th century when slavery was still existent, but up in the North, in places like Philadelphia, Washington, even New York and Chicago to a smaller extent, there was a class of free Black people who had never been enslaved, who educated themselves, and who were sort of the leaders of their community. And they were middle class in their aspirations. They were highly assimilated. They studied the classics of English literature. They were almost Anglophiles. They embraced the Victorian tradition, which was a series of manners and codes about how you behaved. And they felt that if they behaved in that kind of way, in a middle class, sort of stiff upper lip kind of way, that would be protection against racism. It'd be a kind of armor. And so that formed his upbringing, and he embraced that totally. The also other part of it was culture. Culture with a capital C, as some people said, that culture was a system of relationships and appreciations. You learned all the classics, and by your knowledge of that classics, those classics, you showed you were a civilized man, particularly at that time. And so that was his core values, which he got from his father, but even more so from his mother, that the way you behaved allowed you to sort of manage racism from a middle class standpoint by assimilating as much of American and particularly European culture as possible.
As you explained, though, his position in the middle class was economically tenuous. You talk about a childhood that was in which his parents, especially his mother, really strove to ensure he had the opportunities that we would think of for the time as middle class opportunities.
Yes, well, his father died when he was 6, and so that took, you know, a breadwinner out of the family. She was a school teacher in Philadelphia schools and then later in Camden, New Jersey schools. And so, you know, $500 a year or something like that was what, you know, she received. And but yet she sent him to these great public schools that were available in Philadelphia. Central High was an elite public school. And he went there and he excelled. But of course, he ended up going to Harvard. And then he, after excelling at Harvard, he was the first African-American Rhodes Scholar to Oxford. And while he did get fellowship money, particularly during the time at Harvard, they were always basically pulling together pieces of money, paying off debts, paying his tuition, borrowing. And it was a tremendous amount of stress, although interestingly, it was a lot of stress on her. But he looked at it as a kind of game. He believed that he was owed the best education that America or Europe had to offer, and that if he had to, you know, manipulate and cheat some people out of some money or whatever to make that possible, that the end, his education as a cultured person justified those means.
What sort of education was he thinking of, and what sort of education did his mother aspire for him?
Well, that he would be a person who would be cultured. So that means he would know all of English literature. He would know all of European art. He would be an expert on civilization as it was. You know, Western civilization was the core value and body of knowledge, it's sort of the best that's ever been fought and said, Matthew Arnold's notion of culture. The problem, of course, is that in that citadel of culture, there was usually no place for anybody African-American or African. And so he's kind of a person who's invading that space and eventually, particularly when he gets to Harvard, begins to want to find some way to use that theory of culture to advance himself as the interpreter of an African-American or Afro-American culture. The problem, of course, is that that whole idea of Western civilization inculcated in him a dislike for things African and things African-Americans. So in his life, there's always this struggle. He's repulsed, in a sense, by lower-class blacks. He wants to avoid being associated with them. At the same time, he needs a culture from African-Americans, largely generated from by working-class African-Americans, in order to announce himself as a man of culture, of black culture. So that tension explodes during his time at Harvard from 1904 to 1907, and really continues throughout the rest of his life.
I hope we can return back to that a little bit when we talk about the 1920s, when you really see a lot of that, those threads coming together in terms of what he's doing. But I want to talk a bit, I want to ask you a bit more about his time at Harvard, because as you explained, he was not he was not the first African American there, but it was definitely a point at which he was traversing a world in which African Americans are not commonplace. And I was especially fascinated by your description as to how that calculus played out when it came to his application of the Rhodes Scholarship. I was wondering if you could elaborate upon that little bit.
Yes. Well, I guess it was basically 1906 or so, and it's not really clear when he first started thinking about it, but he had this feeling that he wanted to go to Europe. That, you know, in those days, if you were a cultured person and of the upper class, of course you'd go to Harvard or Princeton or whatever, but you had to go to Europe. You had to have the grand tour. You had to be exposed to European culture. But he didn't have the money that his other classmates had to basically just go over and, as they would say, soak up culture on his own. So the Rhodes Scholarship, which gave you 3 years at Oxford, was the means to him accomplishing that. But he was very skillful at thinking about that. If he let it be known generally at Harvard that he was going to go for the Rhodes Scholarship, there might be opposition. Because one of his other friends had announced that he was going for various fellowships, and some of his white friends and even faculty members opposed that. So he went about the process of applying somewhat secretively, finding out from his mother when the exams were held. And then he also decided to go from apply from Pennsylvania rather than New Jersey. His aunt and uncle lived in Pennsylvania, and he always put that down as his address, but his actual address was in New Jersey. But New Jersey was a far more competitive, because they only picked basically, you know, one person from each state. And in New Jersey, there's Princeton. There was a lot of competition. So eventually he passed the exam, and then he went down to Pennsylvania for an interview. And they announced then that they had selected him, and a tremendous amount of controversy erupted in the United States, because at that time the Rhodes Scholarship was considered the sign of intellectual accomplishment, in the stratosphere, and that a black person, or Negro as they called it at that time, was the recipient of this scholarship, struck some people as a contradiction. Even one of his professors later on said that he thought it was an error of judgment, because to be a Rhodes Scholar meant you were a representative of American civilization. And that professor thought no Negro could really be a representative of American civilization.
You describe the awarding of the Rhodes Scholarship to Locke as controversial, and that best describes the reaction among many whites. As you describe it, among African Americans, though, it made Locke a celebrity.
Yes, it did. And many people seized on it. I think he didn't anticipate the extent to which the black population, in 1907 was hungry for something that would validate that they had arrived, that essentially 40 some years after the end of slavery, that there could be an African-American who could compete intellectually on the same stage with the most wealthy and prestigious white students of his time. That really meant something. A great well of race pride came forward, which was good in one sense, but which he chafed against a little bit, because at that time, in 1907, he really wanted to say that this is my achievement as an individual. And so over time, he became more and more annoyed with the fact that people were claiming him as their representative. He didn't like that.
What was his time at Oxford like?
Well, when he first was going over on the boat, I think he imagined that this would be a glorious time, sort of like the time he had had at Harvard, which had been one of his best times ever in his life as an undergraduate, and that he would maybe even find a way to escape the American race problem by maybe becoming a permanent expatriate or a diplomat or whatever. But when he got over there, he ran squarely into American racism and, of course, British complicity with that racism, because scholars from the southern states were aghast that a black person was among them. And so they went about making things very difficult for him. He ended up being in one of the less sophisticated colleges. The Rhodes Trust wouldn't place him in the colleges that he wanted to be in, Magdalen and others. The Southern Rhodes Scholars prevailed on the Rhodes Trust to not invite him to the Thanksgiving dinner that all of the Americans in Oxford, let alone just the Rhodes Scholars, were invited to. And it was really his friend Horace Callan who actually, with another American at Oxford, held a separate Thanksgiving dinner for him. And while he never discussed it in his letters to his mother, which he wrote almost every other day, it deeply wounded him and confirmed to him that even abroad, he would have to deal with the fact that among certain whites, he was considered a pariah, and that the idea that he would be able to escape racism by going abroad was really a myth.
You also describe it as a period of great personal awakening for him. You, going back to his homosexuality, it was something that he recognized well before. But in England, it seems he felt he had greater freedom in which to explore it and understand it.
Yes, I think that's true. I think that the compensation of his being excluded and demonized by the Southern Rhodes scholars who, you know, would try to make his life miserable on the streets of Oxford, was that his homosexuality connected with a certain group of students at Oxford who themselves were gay, and he became part of that community, and that was a sort of second home for him. I think the other thing, though, that Oxford provided him with is connection with other people of color, particularly colonials, people from India, from Egypt, from Sri Lanka, who were at Oxford because, you know, they had excelled in their school systems, and they came with a critique of imperialism and a critique of colonialism and showed him that, in a sense, what he was struggling against in America and even in England was analogous to what they were struggling with, that racism wasn't just an American problem. It was part of a larger framework of imperialism and colonialism, and that one of the things he had to do was to embrace and celebrate that his native culture and critique the larger Western civilization that he had been so enamored of when he was a schoolboy in Philadelphia.
How did his degree progress work? Because Rhodes scholars often were given an opportunity to earn a bachelor's there. And Locke himself undertook that journey. And you describe he goes to Berlin as well. What exactly happened there?
He came over wanting to get what's called a B.Lit., which is a Bachelor of Literaries, which is essentially a degree in the classics. To do that, you have to be able to read and write criticism of texts that are in Greek and Latin. And while he had taken Greek and Latin in high school and Harvard, he never had been exposed to it at the level that the students in England were. So when he started to really have to be pressured to do that work, he had difficulty. And he got tutors and whatever, but eventually reached a point where he realized he really couldn't do it. So then he shifted. That's when he really became completely invested in philosophy. Up to that point, he'd been in literature and philosophy. Then he tried to get a bachelor's of science in philosophy. And that was a little more unusual. It was kind of like a graduate degree in today's term. And he chose a somewhat odd topic, value theory. Value theory at this time was something that was mainly from Austria and Germany. And so it wasn't probably the most politic thing for him to choose to work on at Oxford. But he pursued it nevertheless. He went to Germany. He took courses at the University of Berlin, and he wrote essentially a 400-page thesis for his degree on the concept of value, but it was not approved by his committee. They were not convinced of his argument. They also were critical of him. There was a sense that his behavior that had not been what was appropriate. He had tried to live the life of the man of gentlemanly culture there. He'd run up debts. He had been, in the American terminology, too uppity for the British officials. And so they punished him by sending him down without a degree. And this was a tremendous personal embarrassment to him. I mean, the idea that he would not be able to come away from Oxford with a degree was something he had never predicted. And many years later, I found that he had written a note to himself really in the 1930s where he ruminated over the great embarrassment of it. The embarrassment was such that when he returned to the United States, he actually masqueraded and said that he had gotten a degree. And he rationalized it that, well, since he was a race hero, if he came back without a degree, it would be embarrassment with the race and he'd have to explain how he'd been a victim of racism, and et cetera, et cetera. And so it was a deep-seated wound for him that he failed to get the degree there. He eventually compensated somewhat by going back to Harvard and getting a PhD in philosophy in 1918. And in terms of his career as a professor in the United States, that actually was much more valuable anyway. But he still never really completely lived down the embarrassment of that failure at Oxford.
But well before he completed his PhD at Harvard, he took up a position at Howard University. And I was wondering if you could explain a bit what the importance of Howard University and the initial position that Locke took up within the institution.
Yes, well, Howard University had been created in the early Reconstruction period as part of the nation's obligation to educate what was called the freedmen at that time. And it had been a tremendous source of support in the Black community. His father even had gone to Howard University and gotten a law degree there, although he was never actually able to practice law because of prejudice. But Howard was the most prestigious, and it was a university. So many of the historically Black colleges at that time were not universities. Howard was a university that even had philosophy. It was just a citadel of knowledge. And the only other alternative that we really had at that time was to go to Tuskegee, which was Tuskegee Institute in Alabama. And he was actually slated possibly to go there. But in the end, Booker T. Washington wrote a letter to Howard and allowed him to go to Howard and become a professor or really lecturer in the Teachers College there. So initially he taught teaching pedagogy. That's really what Howard's bread and butter was to educate people to go out and become teachers in the public schools in America. Eventually, after he got his PhD, he was able to move into the College of Letters and Science and teach philosophy, which was really unusual. It was the only school in the United States, historically Black universities and colleges for many years, that had a philosophy department rather than a religious department. So he was quite saved in a way by Howard University.
You open the book with this very fascinating scene, which is you open the book in 1921 with the death of his mother, who had come to Washington to live with her son. And you present it at the beginning of the book as sort of a pivot point in Locke's life. And I was wondering if you could explain exactly how it was a pivot point and what it led Locke to do.
Yes, well, it was 1922. And after he returned to Harvard in 1916 to study for his PhD, he had his mother retire and join him in Boston at graduate school, because I think he somewhat suspected that being at Oxford, he had been essentially too far away from his from her emotional support. So he brought her with him to grad school, and he was a success. And after that year in Boston, he brought his mother back to Washington, D.C., where she lived with him when he resumed his teaching as a professor at Howard University. So they lived together, closely from, say, 1916 to 1922. They had always had a very intense relationship, but they lived together. And then she became ill very briefly, and she died at home. And part of the story that unearthed during this research was that various people said that when she died, he held a wake at his house for his mother, and he invited people over. And when they got there, she was propped up on the couch and as if she was alive. And he held tea with the assembled guests with her for the last time. And of course, this sort of shocked the people at the time. But some people, like Georgia Douglas Johnson, who was a poet, in Washington, D.C., recognized that this was a sign that Locke was going to have great difficulty coping with the fact that his mother was no longer there. As an isolated gay man with very few friends in a black community in Howard and Washington, D.C., that was very middle class, he was a very isolated person. And she had been the one person that gave him unqualified regard, support, and praise. So where was he going to find that? He had to almost confront the fact that he was, for the first time in his 30s, going to have to be an adult. And so that pushed him out. He went to Berlin, which was sort of a place where he always felt comfortable because of his gay identity. But he also witnessed in Berlin sort of the Weimar Republic's awakening of modernist culture, and decided to come back to the United States and to become a leader, a spokesperson for that culture, that modernism, when a worldwide phenomenon, was best represented in the United States by the art and culture of African Americans. He didn't really like jazz that much. Nevertheless, everybody at that time was saying jazz was a modernist cultural form. And so he thought, maybe I can find a kind of second home among artists and writers, playwrights, classical musicians, singers like Roland Hayes, people who essentially love the arts, and we can kind of use the arts to advance the sense of respect and pride internally for black people, but also their reputation as culture contributors to whites and others outside the group.
How did he feel that he could best do this? What was sort of approach to achieving this goal did he have in mind?
Well, since he wasn't really a successful creative writer himself, he had to work through other people. Unlike, say, T.S. Eliot, you know, who wrote The Wasteland and other poems and kind of articulated and then criticized and created the critical framework. Well, Locke didn't have that. So what he had to do was work with other artists, and particularly young men like County Cullen, Langston Hughes, Gene Toomer. Those are probably the three, Claude McKay. Those four were already beginning to write a new kind of black literature. Claude McKay was using the sonnet form to essentially create a kind of protest literature. His If We Must Die poem, which had been written during the race riots in 1919, asserted a kind of right for self-defense among black people. County Cullen was sort of writing, you know, wonderful lyric poetry that was really very beautiful and suggested that black people had as much of a sense and entitlement for beauty as any other people. And then Langston Hughes was trying to find a form that expressed the beauty in working class black people. Later on, he would develop blues poems, which would be quite powerful. Gene Toomer, who was living in Washington and actually had several meetings and conversations with Locke, went down south and wrote a poetic novel, Cain, that talked about the beauty and culture in unlettered, uneducated black people. So they were providing him with the material that he could then use to argue for a renaissance, you know, that Africans had come over and they'd had a racial inheritance and culture. It had been suppressed for much of the time in the United States, and now it was experiencing a rebirth in the 1920s, in the writings of these several poets.
So he's writing about this as a critic. He's writing essays, he's giving speeches, and you describe in particular a collection that he puts together in 1925, and how that helps to sort of crystallize a lot of these, bring together a lot of these different strands and concentrate them and show what's taking place.
Yes. Yeah. Well, he was asked, he was asked by Paul Kellogg, who was the editor of the Survey Graphic, which was a progressive reform magazine, to edit a special issue called Harlem, Mecca of the New Negro. where this awakening of these various writers would be tied to the emergence of Harlem as a cultural center in the United States. Because after all, Harlem had emerged roughly 1917, 1918 as a center because of the Great Migration. A lot of black people had moved up from the South to the North. A lot of institutions in black culture had sited themselves in Harlem. The NAACP was sited there. Marcus Garvey's Universal Negro Improvement Organization was sited there. So it was kind of a center. And Paul Kellogg wanted to tie this sociological emergence to this aesthetic blossoming. And so he asked Locke to write the essays for that. And so Locke did. And he worked together with the artists and writers. He worked with the German artist Winold Reiss in illustrating the issue. And so when that came out in March 1st, 1925, it was the most successful issue of a survey graphic that they had ever had, announcing this new black subjectivity called the New Negro, as cited in Harlem. Unfortunately for Locke, not long after that, he was fired from Howard University because he was considered something of an upstart and malcontent on advocating a faculty getting more money in their salaries, etc. And that allowed him to devote all his time to turning this special issue into a book, the anthology you mentioned. And it was called The New Negro, an Interpretation. And it was an expanded version of the survey graphic. And he welcomed in diverse articles, poetry, drama, all sorts of things. And the New Negro was revealed through the art. So that was the key conceit that he had, that it wasn't just that black people were creating art and poetry that was laudable. It was that that art announced a new identity, this new Negro who was removed from the old Negro of the slave past and was asserting that he or she could determine their future rather than being bounded in completely by racism and prejudice.
You describe this movement, which has enormous import, and yet you also personalize what's going on in terms of Locke's personal relationships with people like Langston Hughes, like Zora Neale Hurston. And I thought that was very interesting because it was far from harmonious. And as you describe, sometimes Locke was seeking things in these relationships that weren't always going to be possible.
Yes, well, part of this crisis, let's say, that unfurled in him with the death of his mother was an incredible amount of emotional neediness, which he largely managed through his sexuality. And so when he was in Europe, of course, he could pursue relationships without any, immediate consequences. When he came back, he's living in Washington, he felt like he was scrutinized. So often he pursued relationships with the very artists that he was also trying to promote their work. And so this created a lot of pressures, both for him and for them. So particularly with Langston Hughes, who he really loved. Langston Hughes didn't want to have a relationship, at least a sexual relationship, it seemed, with Locke. And Locke continued to pursue it in various different ways. And that complicated and in some cases ruined some of these relationships because of that neediness on his part. At the same time, with women like, say, Jessie Fawcett and others, he was very competitive and misogynist. Can't really prove it, but it seemed as if there may have been some early desire or some sort of possible romantic attachment or desire on the part of Jessie Fawcett with Locke. And so he repulsed her and was really quite cruel to her. So this is one of the tensions in his life, is that he wants to advance this argument that Black people will be liberated, essentially, through the work of artists. And he needs those artists, since he's not an artist himself. And yet at the same time, he puts such pressure on those artists to satisfy so many of his needs that he often drives them away.
You mentioned that he needs the artist. He also needs something else, too. He needs money. And one of the other interesting parts about this point in his life is this issue of patronage. And I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit upon how that shaped a lot of what he's trying to do and a lot of the ideas that he was trying to advance if he could get the money for them.
Yeah, so even before, in 1924 or so, he and Charles Johnson, who was head of Opportunity Magazine, were searching for money to support what they were trying to do. So if they thought that writing and art could actually be a kind of second front in the war against racism, they needed to find some way to pay writers and others to do it. So Johnson came up with this thing called the Opportunity Writers Contest, where they would pay people prizes to write the best poem or the best book or whatever. And they held those. So they went about trying to raise money. And Johnson often used Locke, who was more of the esthete, as the person in there. One of the people they went after was Albert Barnes, who was head of the Barnes Foundation. He was a millionaire, and he was involved in progressive causes. But he was also, you know, a narcissist and a megalomaniac. So he was always... Yeah, he had some money, but it was very difficult to get the money out of him. And this is one of the things that becomes a problem for Locke, is how do you get people, largely white people, with money to support this Black movement? He ends up meeting during the time when he's not employed by Howard, a woman named Charlotte Mason. She attends an exhibition of African art that he put together. And after that, he talks to her about all of his dreams of, you know, having these artists supported, almost like he was trying to run his own national endowment of the arts. And he wanted her to give him the money to do that. And she was convinced of that to a certain extent. And she gave money, $200 a month. She provided for a time to Zora Neale Hurston to pay her to write her books. She provided money to Langston Hughes and many other artists that Locke brought to her. But the complication was that she also was a megalomaniac and a control freak. So she wanted to control all the aspects of the production, almost like it was an assembly line. And she would pressure them to turn out work on a certain schedule, and it had to be work of a certain type. She had a very particular notions of what was authentic and inauthentic Blackness in the works, even contradicting and overruling at times what Locke felt. So after a while, that relationship got out of control, where he was, yes, they were receiving money, but they were being brutalized in the process of getting the kind of support they needed to do the work. And eventually, it fell apart with a great deal of bitterness on all people's part.
To what degree did those difficulties in terms of raising money and doing things like building the museum that they were talking about in Harlem, to what degree did that contribute to the decline of Alain Locke's involvement with the new Negro movement and the Harlem Renaissance?
Yes, well, I think that it began, say, 27, 28, with him trying to hold on to the movement. Because once he was no longer at Howard, and then he got his job back in 1927, but basically he didn't have independent funds. Whites sort of moved in and sort of adopted the Harlem Renaissance in the 1926-27. And he felt like his voice, his ability to shape what kind of art people did, was being drowned out by people with more financial resources. So he needed the resources to hold on to a tenuous position. And yet the resources ended up alienating him from the very people he wanted to influence. And so after that period of time, roughly 1930-31, is when the various artists leave Mrs. Mason. They decide they don't want to accept her money anymore. After that, He basically doesn't have really any direct influence on the writers. He still has some influence on a second group, though, that begins to emerge, which is the visual artists. The visual artists of the New Negro really emerge later, 26, 27, and 28. And that leads him to bond with another patron, Mary Beatty Brady, who is the director of the Harmon Foundation. And he got her through the Harmon Foundation to host a number of exhibitions at which prizes were given to African-American artists for producing art. And he began to influence them in terms of the type of art they should do. And really, 1931, 1933, he's really able to shape how visual artists are at least talking about Negro art through that patron. So one of the things that's really interesting about Locke is his resourcefulness that even in the midst of failures, sometimes devastating failures, and I would think, you know, would set me back a couple of years, he would just say, okay, that particular avenue didn't work. He'd take a couple of days to lick his wounds, and then he would be out there finding another person because he was convinced that the basic idea was correct. It was just finding the right people to support it. And all the people he found were flawed, but if he could manipulate and sort of improvise between the various people, institutions, patrons, and artists, he could create a kind of cultural ferment that would be sustaining. And I have to say, it's quite amazing that even into the early parts of the years of the Depression, he does keep money flowing to some artists. But by about 1935, the whole thing basically is coming to an end, and he's not able to have the influence either on writers or painters that he had had in the earlier period.
There's another aspect, though, that he does continue to pursue in the 1930s, and that's this notion of broader education, that maybe he can't influence the production, but maybe he can influence the reception. I was wondering if you could talk a bit about what he was doing there in terms of his writings and in terms of his other efforts.
Yes. Well, he begins to, I think, learn from the lessons of working with individual patrons that he needs to actually work with more corporate patrons. And this follows a transition generally in artistic patronage in the 20th century away from individuals and to institutions that will provide money through foundations. So he essentially comes up with the idea of an adult education program. And what he wants to do is he wants to get money from the Carnegie Corporation through the American Association of Adult Education to fund the production of what he calls bronze booklets. These would be a series of books that would be easy to read and understand, written by Black scholars about the key areas of culture that he was interested in. So something on African-American visual arts, music, literature, theater, race studies, adult education, history. He lays this out, and he works to get the Carnegie Foundation and also the Adult Education Association to fund this. And he gets a grant for $5,000 to pay essentially mostly writers and scholars at Howard University to write these booklets. And then he sets up a distribution system completely out of his post office box in Washington, D.C. to sell these books to libraries in the South, to bookstores, small African-American bookstores. Some of them even go to prisons where the incarcerated actually read these books, creating a knowledge about culture through these booklets. Of course, there's conflict here too, because even though it's a little easier working with these foundations, they still have various ways of policing knowledge. So in one case, he reaches out to Bubby B. Du Bois to produce a booklet. And in the course of Du Bois, who by the 1930s, 1938, was a very strong militant and critic of the New Deal, Du Bois wrote a very incendiary pamphlet, and the American Association of Adult Education had on the board a white expert. And that white expert was reviewing the manuscripts, and he objected to Du Bois's manuscript. And eventually, it came to a head where Locke either had to persist with trying to publish Du Bois's manuscript and lose all the funding, or, you know, basically not publish Du Bois's. And he decides not to publish Du Bois's manuscript, and instead has someone like Ralph Bunche and others, younger generation people who are very militant in their own way, but weren't associated with the kind of radicalism of Du Bois. And I see this as a kind of turning point. On the one hand, it's very negative in the sense that, you know, Du Bois was a colleague and it really went against the values that Locke had said were going to operate in this thing. But at the same time, by not having Du Bois in there, Locke for the first time sort of separates himself from being in Du Bois's shadow. And that series goes on to be very popular in the late 1930s. It sells out the first printings of almost all of the first books. It's enormously successful. But by the 1940s, with the coming of World War II, the sort of market for this dries up, and they basically stop publishing by the end of around 1944, 1945.
And yet, right up to the end of his life, Locke never really stops all these efforts. I mean, practically up till the very end, he's still engaged very much with this cultural promotion, by which time you're talking about a whole new generation of writers and artists and a whole different, new styles within art emerging, and how he's grappling with that. And it just fascinates me how he's right there throughout it all.
Yes, I think he finds with Richard Wright and others emerging in the 1930s, the emergence of what he calls proletarian literature. That is a literature that focuses on the black working class. There had been always that there in the earlier part, but it always had been aestheticized and romanticized. In Richard Wright, you have sort of the angry black working class, particularly epitomized in the book Native Son. Locke comes out and actually defends Wright around that book when many people were criticizing it, and sees this as the latest new iteration of the New Negro. So the New Negro for him was not a fixed identity. It was kind of an evolving zeitgeist, and it had taken on much more criticality, much more of a socialist identity by the late 1930s and early 40s. And so Locke began to evolve his own position with that. He didn't want to become, a back number. He was very concerned that people would not call out his name anymore. And so he continually reinvents himself in order to stay current with the times.
Wow. Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Well, I'm just, it took me quite a bit of time to do this book. So I'm taking a pause and just kind of surveying the landscape. I am interested in the way in which there is kind of a new Negro today, which is somewhat related to the emergence of Afrofuturism and the film The Black Panther. And I was thinking about that as kind of a new phase that I might want to write about. I think Locke would be very interested in that because it does, again, cite black agency back in Africa. That was something that he was very supportive of. It's also an act of the imagination, so it's not something that's, completely bound by the political controversies of the day. And it also inspires a sense of great pride And I think that was one of the things he wanted to always do, is that despite what is going on in the racial conflicts of the time, that black people and even white people had the ability to turn away from the megaphone of racism and focus on the inherent beauty in the black experience, and particularly in black people, and the potential to create out of the most desperate times something transcendent. So I'm thinking a little bit about the Afrofuturism. I did an essay on Norman Lewis and Afrofuturism for the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts. And so I'm thinking about that.
Well, it sounds like a very relevant project.
Yes.
Well, Jeffrey Stewart, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you.